Welcome to World Affairs, a weekly broadcast of Conversations at the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, CEO. This week's episode focuses on the ways in which the Middle East has changed in the 5 years since the Arab Spring. We'll hear from Nancy O'Kyle. She's executive director of the Tahrir Institute for Middle East Policy, and she's in conversation with David Arnold, president of the Asia Foundation. This event was recorded in San Francisco before a World Affairs audience. And now to our moderator, David Arnold.
Well, thank you very much. It's a great pleasure for me to be here tonight for a couple of reasons. First of all, I think the topic of reflecting on 5 years since the Arab Spring is one that is of tremendous interest to me, particularly since I missed all the action. I left Cairo actually 1 month before the Arab Spring took place. So I've been watching from a distance, and I'm really interested in hearing what our guest has to say about what's transpired over these past 5 years. But it's also a pleasure for me to introduce Dr. Nancy O'Kyle for another reason, and that is that she holds both her bachelor's degree and a master's degree from the American University in Cairo. And she reminded me that I actually presented her with her diploma in 2003 for her master's degree, and she was the commencement speaker. So, you know, there's another reason that I'm very happy to have her here in San Francisco with us today. Dr. Nancy O'Kyle serves as the executive director of the Tahrir Institute for Middle East Policy. And speaking with her about the work of the institute, she said, "It is not a think tank. We concentrate on three A's: analysis, advocacy, and action." And I think that's a really good description of this is not a think tank, but more of a do tank, if you will. But the work that she and her colleagues do is really focused on really understanding what's taking place in terms of the political developments and human rights issues, not just in Egypt, but across the Middle East. In addition to her undergraduate and graduate studies at AUC, she's a PhD from the University of Sussex in the UK. And her focus was on power relations and foreign aid. So, Nancy, we're delighted to welcome you. Why don't we give you a few minutes just to reflect, if you would, on what has transpired and what changes do you see taking place 5 years after the Arab Spring?
Well, thank you so much, David, and thank you for having me here. And it's a pleasure to reconnect again 13 years later. I think looking at what's happening in the region right now, 5 years after the Arab Spring, after like the euphoria that we've seen 5 years ago and optimism, a lot of people are, and particularly policymakers, are misreading the situation in the Middle East right now, that the current chaos and spread of violence and increase in insurgency is an outcome of the Arab Spring. And I think this is a misdiagnosis of the situation. What actually happened is that it is the reason for the unmet demands that were raised 5 years ago when people took to the streets and had some legitimate demands. And the irony is that, I mean, as David said, I mean, it was 13 years ago when I finished my master's degree, and in my commencement speech, it was right after the American invasion of Iraq, and I think the message of my speech was that, I mean, this is an important alarming sign, and the important thing is to look for the future and invest in the people. And then democracy and freedom are the long-term goals. And the lack of accountability is the reason for the continuation of authoritarianism. Of that, 13 years on, it's the same message. But I think policymakers have a hard or short memory. They don't learn from history. Most of the leaders on both sides, they tend to look at short-term solutions and immediate solutions. This is, and also they tend to deal with the symptoms of the problem, not the roots of it. So if we see, one of the biggest, challenges in the region right now is what the so-called Islamic State or ISIS. And everyone is trying to find ways and questions on how did this happen and how can we combat Daesh or ISIS. But actually, ISIS is just a symptom of the problem. There is not the root of the problem. There are so many roots for this problem, including sectarianism in the region and those who feed on sectarianism in the region, lack of justice, lack of accountability, the oppression that people, suffer under authoritarian regimes there. These are all different factors that we can elaborate on later in the conversation. But unfortunately, the overview, it's hard to generalize about the Middle East because each country is unique still. But there are common factors, and one of the most common factors is that the short-sightedness and the inclination of policymakers to deal with immediate issues rather than having long-term solutions.
Nancy, you've described this tension between the pull for particularly Western governments to support the Sisi regime because of security considerations and the fight against ISIS and anti-terrorism, and to tend to overlook or discount some of the violations of human rights, the constricting of press freedom, many of the other abuses that we're seeing. How do, as you interact and engage with policymakers, how do they sort of respond and react to your view that, this is short-sighted and focusing on the security and anti-terrorism fight and overlooking or discounting some of these longer-term systemic abuses?
Well, let me take a step back and talk a little bit about how we present the problem to them and look at the situation in Egypt in particular. So if we look at the Sisi term, he is a leader that presented himself to the Egyptians and to the world as the guardian of Egyptian secularism. And trying to prevent the Islamism from changing the identity of the Egyptian population and protecting the rights and freedoms of particularly of minorities. Egypt has 15% of the population almost of Coptic Christians, and there are other minorities there, and then declared the war on terrorism. So let's talk about statistics first. The number of attacks in 2014, which is a year after he declared that, increased by 50% from that time until today. And the number of attacks in the first 3 months of 2015 alone was equal to the entire number of attacks that happened in 2014. So definitely the security approach of arrest and carpet bombing and repression is not working. And that's just in terms of numbers. But qualitatively also, the sophistication of terror groups have increased. So for example, sporadic terror groups, small terror groups in Sinai, they managed to form a sort of a conglomerate under what was then called Ansar Beit al-Maqdis, that later declared its loyalty to ISIS and called itself the Sinai province or Wilayat Sinai, which, if not even extending resources and extending actual material support from them, but at least they are extending symbolic power. So that is one of the things, looking at what this regime has came and proposed to deliver to the people. And the second thing that they propose to deliver to the people is stability and economic development. And they fail to deliver on both, okay? On the other hand, civil society are trying to, express their concern, document violations. We've seen also an increase on the level of repression, number of people that are being arrested, laws that are being passed that are repressing more freedoms, including the demonstration law that, I mean, a lot of people have been arrested under that law, and then changing the penal code of receiving funding from a foreign government, which is 5 years in prison, which was my prison sentence, is now turned into a life sentence. So I got away with a, a lighter sentence. I got off easy. So, and most of the civil society organizations who are documenting and advocating for human rights and press freedom are actually either being arrested or living under the threat of being detained. And this is in addition of a huge smear campaign in the media that actually portray them as traitors or agents of the West, and they are trying to create unrest. Now, the problem is not just that this is in and of itself is a violation of human rights, but also it creates another security concern, because when you repress independent media, and there are no resources for actual credible media other than you have the government or a state-controlled media that is not credible and even late in producing any clear statements about the situation in the country, then you are creating a knowledge and information gap. This gap is being filled by the terror organization, who are actually having the upper hand in telling their story and dominating the narrative. So one of the examples is when there is the Russian plane that was downed last year in Sinai. Nothing was heard from the Egyptian government side for a long time. The independent media, they did not have access to actually talk or write about. Actually, there was a media gag that was placed on this. Meanwhile, the first people to issue a clear and specific statement about this was Wilayat Sinai, or the ISIS group in Sinai, stating what they have done and controlled, I mean, the message, why they did it, and what is the objective of it. And they actually, we had the control of keeping away how they did it. They didn't say, for example, they bombed the plane or they shot the plane down. They just said, we downed it, which was a very, I mean, like a kind of a deviation from their standard statements. And then later on, I mean, like, meanwhile, their Twitter accounts that are supportive of ISIS, we're gloating over social media saying, like, we're going to leave you like that, wondering how we did it. So it's like, again, like proving like having the upper hand and what kind of information are to be released. And then later on, they explain how they did it and exactly what the plan and the plot and what happened. So you are having a government that is failing to provide real and credible and, verified information. You have absence of free media and free independent journalists who can actually talk about it, and a space that is being filled by the terror organization. So this is a security threat. So this is how we talk about it, basically.
So on this point exactly, we saw earlier this week the inadvertent release of a set of Interior Ministry guidelines on how to manage the press, which is the subject actually of an editorial in today's New York Times. Was there anything surprising to you in those guidelines?
It's how classic it is. we're talking about a regime that is aging. Yes, the figures, the heads of the states are changing, but it's the same military regime operating from the same playbook since 1952. So luckily, they are not creative. And that's the silver lining, is that not just like in Egypt, but generally authoritarian regimes in general are very typical in their approaches. They're not innovative and they're not creative. And they are still thinking with a mindset of control. Particularly, I mean, with the mindset of a military, it's like there is like orders that are giving and then implementation happens, people following the orders. But in an age and time, I mean, like, and I'm speaking here in San Francisco, it's like the hub of social media and technology. I mean, this is ridiculous and laughable for a lot of people, mm-hmm. because first of all, you cannot keep information. There are alternative channels for people to provide an alternative narrative or the alternative story. And meanwhile, again, back to the security threat and how this is not just ridiculous and laughable. You have on the other side highly sophisticated and social media savvy, I mean, young people who are joining the extremist groups. So on the same day that this, I mean, New York Times editorial comes out, ISIS today issued 6 videos. Each one of them having a message in support of ISIS Egypt, or IS Egypt, Walayat Sinai. And the videos are very specific and crafted with a message that is talking about a current issue. They talked about the 2 islands that Egypt handed to Saudi Arabia. They talked about the bridge project between Egypt and Saudi Arabia. They talked about the failure of the government to deliver on development and the issues and the grievances of people. So, and they talked about the Israeli-Palestinian issue. So they know exactly who their target audience are. They know how to stay current. They know how to craft a message for this audience. So you're having a regime that is aging and incapable of actually even managing their own authoritarian dictated message. Or on the other hand, you have groups that are very updated and very adaptive to the changes that are happening on the ground. So again, I mean, this is a real security threat.
Nancy, I want to ask you to talk a little bit about your own personal experience. You were working for Freedom House as their director of the Egypt programs, and were arrested and were put on trial. Say a little bit about what led to that, what that experience was like. You were part of a group of about 35 NGO workers that all were prosecuted for your activities. But I think it would be helpful just for us to have a little bit of an understanding of that piece of your own personal history.
So, as you mentioned at the beginning, like in before I left Egypt in 2005 for my PhD, I was working with the Ministry of International Cooperation, ironically under Minister Faiza Vunaga, and I was responsible of evaluating the impact of foreign aid that are coming into the country on the socio-economic and political situation in the country. I left then, and I, at the same time, was also working on several initiatives on democracy promotion and human rights, which at that time under Mubarak was laughable. I mean, I used to tell people would ask me, it's like, what do you do? And I say, I work on human rights and democracy, and people are like, seriously, what do you do? It's like,
those were the good old days.
Imagine at that time. And in 2011, after I had finished my degree and I was working on consultancies in England, the revolution happened, and I was so excited to just leave everything and pack my things and my family and go back to Egypt. I was offered to be the country director of the Egypt program of Freedom House in Egypt. And that was the time of the transition where Egypt was under the rule of the Supreme Council of Armed Forces, I mean SCAF. By the time I arrived, there was already a huge smear campaign in the media against foreign organization and foreign-funded NGOs, again, calling them as traitors or agents of foreign governments who are trying to foment fear among the young Egyptians and create violence and sectarian rifts and all this. And then the classic tactics that we were used to in the past were implemented, the threats, phone calls, intimidation, low-key harassment. And it wasn't too long before I got summoned for questioning. The first time I was summoned, I stayed there for 7 hours, interrogated. And the two charges they gave me were mainly administrative charges. Operating an office without a license and receiving funding from a foreign government without a license. But the rest of the interrogation and the rhetoric around the whole case was all about espionage. It was all political, about my political views. And so it was clear from the beginning that, I mean, the framework of registration and the administrative charges was just a frame to stop the work of human rights organization or, I mean, civil society organizations in general. Shortly after, on December 29th, the Egyptian authorities raided 17 offices of foreign NGOs, which is unprecedented. That didn't happen before. In Freedom House, they raided our office. They held my staff incommunicado for 6 hours, forced them to submit their passwords for their email, the passwords for their laptops, and for their phones, and they confiscated everything. And then later, earlier on in 2012, we were indicted and turned into trial. And from February 2011 until June of 2013, I was on trial. I mean, 6 months of this time I was in Egypt. And then I ended up getting sentenced for 5 years in prison. Again, throughout this time, like what's happening right now, the charges were mainly about, I mean, the legitimacy of those finances, whether we're following the law, the Egyptian law, the Egyptian NGO law. It's exactly what's happening to my colleagues and prominent human rights defenders and society organizations in Egypt. But the discourse in the media and the campaign around it is all about, I mean, breaching national security, and that these people are spreading allegations and defaming Egypt and distorting the image of the country internationally. So that was mainly the case. I mean, and I ended up being here. I live in D.C. in political exile, basically. So that's it.
Thank you for sharing that with us.
Sure.
So I have a number of questions from our guests and the audience. Interested in understanding a little bit about the street protests that are happening now in Cairo and in other parts of Egypt, in particular the popular mood and reaction. You mentioned earlier the giving back or giving over the two islands to Saudi Arabia. To what extent has that been a trigger for some of these protests? And do you sense a shift in the popular mood vis-a-vis support for the Sisi government?
All right. Let me start by the second question first about the popular mood. Unlike the U.S., when you have surveys and polls and statistics and knowing the popularity rate of the candidates like Donald Trump going on the rise. Surveys in Egypt are banned by the law. I mean, you can have surveys, over phone calls, but you cannot actually go in the streets and conduct, interview, public opinion polls. So in order to have specific and scientific methodology to actually measure the actual, acceptance or popularity of a particular president or a particular policy, it's hard to actually say for sure that this is the case. However, I mean, we can get cues and clues from indications all around. I mean, social media, I mean, even mainstream media. So one of the first indications, I mean, you have avid supporters of President Sisi or the regime who are highly supportive of his policies in the past right now are vocally and very critical of him. I mean, very openly in the media. Second, we can also see in the reactions in social media and the tone from breaking away from mild criticism into ridiculing, into satire, into completely mocking and ridiculing his speeches and his talk. So this is also, I mean, especially in the Egyptian context, is always an indication. And then the more serious indication is the spread of the protest or different forms of demonstrations in Egypt. So first of all, let's talk about the formal ones first. And so the formal ones, we have labor strikes, which were almost sustained throughout, I mean, the past 3 years, I mean, like with slight variation. And over the past few months, there was also a clear kind of momentum among the syndicates and their ability to mobilize against the regime or against the president. The most notable of them is the doctors' syndicate protest, which actually was again triggered by the brutality of the police against doctors in a hospital who were forced, I mean, they were trying to force them to forge medical reports. And because they refused, they were beaten up, and the police, I mean, kind of stormed the hospital. And in reaction, there was an emergency session that was called upon by Dr. Mon Amine, I mean, like the head of the syndicate then. And in addition to the doctors who joined the emergency session, 10,000 people showed up. I mean, and it was unexpected. And it was a sign, I mean, that this is not just protesting, but also this is a way of people showing their discontent with what's going on through institutional channels. And that's also, I mean, like another, I mean, new development. Then the same thing happened with the press syndicate. I mean, recently, I mean, just a few days ago, two journalists were detained from inside the press syndicate, which again, ignited a lot of anger, and people were protesting yesterday in front of the press syndicate. These are the formal protests that we can look at and engage. But meanwhile, and this is the most concerning part, is the sporadic, unexpected protests that erupt, again, because of police brutality. I mean, at least there are four incidents in the past few months where a policeman would have a fight with, I mean, a street vendor or a microbus driver, and ending up in, like, shooting them in the head, I mean, like, in the middle of the fight. And that triggers an immediate protest, and sometimes, last year, I mean, in an area called the Darb al-Ahmar in downtown Cairo, where people circled the police station and demanded that they bring the policeman who did that out or try to find some form of accountability. This is something that the regime should be more concerned about, because this is not a kind of a movement. It's not a social movement against a particular cause that they can find ways or detain the head of that movement or try to repress them in any ways. These protests erupt throughout the country unexpectedly, spontaneously. Mm-hmm. And that's more dangerous than any other form of protest. So that should be a really strong, alarming sign for the government to reconsider its approaches, to reconsider the increased police brutality that's been going on, which was actually the main trigger for the January 25th revolution.
You're listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of Conversations at the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, CEO. We're hearing from Nancy O'Kyle. She's executive director of the Tahrir Institute for Middle East Policy. She's in conversation with David Arnold. He's president of the Asia Foundation. This event was recorded in San Francisco before a World Affairs audience. Ours is a membership organization. You can visit us at worldaffairs.org. And now back to our conversation.
In addition to your experience and expertise on Egypt, you and your colleagues at the Institute also focus on Syria, Iraq, Turkey. And we have a couple of questions here related to the Syrian refugee crisis, the war in Syria. Could anything have been done by the interested parties to try and prevent the sort of humanitarian crisis that we've seen as a result of the war in Syria?
Well, I mean, absolutely. I mean, again, if we look back, in March of 2011, the first protest that happened was just a peaceful protest, like any other country, and it was again met by extreme brutality and arrests and shooting, which always creates more anger and violence. And with a society that's being repressed for a long time, I mean, that is the natural reaction. Now, when these things happen and people around, all they can see is violence and repression, and you close down all the peaceful channels of engagement with the country, I mean, they naturally would resort to violence. Given that they are already, terror groups in the region, that would very likely and highly likely would play on this. And the problem is that when the rest of the world, sit and watch this happen and cross one red line after the other, like the use of the chemical weapons in Syria, it's natural that the problem gets worse and worse and worse. Like, as we say, for example, right now in Egypt, this raising the flag, saying this is not going well. You're closing down the peaceful channels. There's already, an ISIS group or a terror group declaring, loyalty to ISIS in Sinai. This should be a significant alarm. And our message to the international community is not to stop support for Egypt, but actually stop turning a blind eye to human rights violation, because this is what's going to happen. So that's, the solution could have been easier years ago. Mm-hmm. Now it's more complicated. Not that there's nothing that can be done right now, but again, there's always this delay. And I think this is not an issue that is specific to the region or specific to particular policymakers. Policymakers in general are very short-sighted, either because, whether intentionally or unintentionally, part of it is like no one wants to leave a legacy of something that they cannot have control over. They want immediate solutions. No one plans a policy that they're going to see their outcome investing, for example, in a society for education for 10 years ahead or decades ahead. They want to see an immediate result. And that's why, most of the policymakers would tend to look into short-term policies.
Can you comment a little bit on the political situation that you see in Turkey, which in some ways is moving in a less democratic direction, and the resignation yesterday of Prime Minister Ahmet Davutoglu is kind of seen by some as a sign of further consolidation of presidential power and control. And what are your observations about what direction Turkey is going, and what that may mean in terms of other regimes in the region?
Well, first of all, I'm not an expert on Turkey, so I would be very reserved if I talk about the domestic politics. But from our perspective, from looking at indications of freedom of the press and freedom of the media, one indication is like one of the, highest country of jailing of journalists is Turkey. And there is a huge repression. This is always an indication of the regime not able to actually respond to issues that are being addressed to them. So that's always a sign. Also, with looking at not far from here, Twitter's statistics, Turkey is the highest country on demands of bringing down content from Twitter. And that's, again, there is a strong correlation between the tendency of a government on trying to silence voices and their ability to deliver. So that, again, I mean, like it's an alarming sign, because the more confident and able you are into delivering on what you're promising, the less, I mean, worried you are that people are speaking out.
One of our audience members asked you if you would please comment on U.S. policy towards Egypt since the Arab Spring started. How has U.S. policy helped or hurt the prospects for a more democratic political system?
Oh, how many hours? I think, first of all, not to single out the U.S., I think it's a problem of international, I mean, community and policies towards Egypt, including the EU as well. And to summarize, the policy of the U.S. is that, first, it did not differ in any way from its approach and direction from the time of Mubarak or even before that. Overall, in terms of the structural approach of how they support the country, I mean, the structure of aid towards Egypt has not changed. I mean, it's like it's the $1.3 billion that are giving in military aid directly. And that defies what President Obama, I mean, declared in his speech after, like, hailing the youth of Egypt after February 11th and saying it's just like it's now the time to be on the right side of history and support the right people. And the understanding of that is actually to support the people, not to support whoever comes in government. And then we resort back and fall into government-to-government policies and ignore the rest of the society. And the second problem is that, and then there's this is the tendency of most international policymakers, is the focus on procedural democracy versus actual change in the rules and laws that governs freedom and the democratic environment in the country. So the focus when Mubarak fell is to go according to a plan and check boxes. So have a constitution and a referendum over it, parliamentary elections, and then presidential elections. And miraculously, this will change the situation in the country. Where you have not changed at all the ability of the people, how to empower the people and civil society organization, how to liberate the media in order for, I mean, let's simplify and even put it simplistically. If you want to have free and fair elections, you need to provide an environment where those who are running for the elections can fairly and openly and transparently present their agenda and their and have a platform for their campaign freely. But you cannot have elections where anyone who's in opposition would be arrested. then it's like, yeah, you are following, I mean, a roadmap. So there was this focus on procedural democracy and kind of, again, turning a blind eye on the lack of actual, I mean, structural changes in the rules and the laws and the mode of governance in the country. So this is a huge problem. And the problem is that there is no learning from very recent history. And I understand that the concern for Western countries in the U.S. that they don't want to see another Syria and Iraq. They don't want things to go out of hand. They don't want to see Egypt in that situation. However, puzzling for me is that all the indications and even past, I mean, history shows that the current policies towards Egypt are not really conducive for a stable Egypt. I mean, Mubarak was seen as the most stable president in the region. And even I think Hillary Clinton publicly stated that few days before he was gone. And just for 18 days of protest, we're capable of, I mean, bringing him down. So that's a lesson in just like thinking that the security situation alone or the security solution alone is the answer to any form of anger or discontent within societies.
One of our audience members poses the kind of bimodal choice that both external players as well as domestic constituents seem to be offered of religious fundamentalists, e.g. the Muslim Brotherhood, the Morsi-type regime, versus an alternative of an authoritarian government that's going to crack down and throw people in jail and repress freedoms. How do you see that choice? I mean, do you see a wider range of alternatives being developed and emerging, or is that in reality the kind of stark choice that people in the Middle East are being faced with?
No, I completely disagree with. The kind of essentialist approach that says, countries in the Middle East or Egypt is only stuck between two choices: the military regime or a religious authoritarianism. I think we've seen in 2011, a lot of diversity of people from different religious and economic and social backgrounds, real diverse group of people who are unhappy with the current situation or the situation then. However, the governments, whether locally or the international community, do drive people into that scenario, because the military regime, for example, in Egypt, was very keen to strike a deal or provide support to the Muslim Brotherhood, not because they favored their political ideology, but with the assumption that they are the guarantors of stability because of their wide support in the community or across the country. Of course, this is a miscalculation because no matter how large the support that the Muslim Brotherhood had in Egypt, within an organization that was operating underground, did not necessarily represent 90 million people. So that's the first miscalculation. The second, not miscalculation, but a misperception for the West and a lot of analysts also within Egypt, is that the divide in Egypt is along the fault line of Islamists and seculars, or Islamists and liberals. This is not really an accurate reading of the situation, because the level of oppression or marginalization is more along the political economic fault lines, or more of the economic fault lines. There's more marginalization for the lower strata of the society, regardless whether they are Islamists or seculars or even Christians or from other minorities that are there in the country. So I think there is a misreading of the situation, and there is an opportunity for other people to emerge, but the later we go into addressing the issues and the grievances within society, the more you drive people into extremism. And again, as I said at the beginning, you are closing down all the peaceful means of engagement with the government, and then you're leaving people for either to be exiled or leaving the country or joining extremist groups.
So one of the questions that our audience has raised is, what can outside groups do to influence and change behavior of the military government or the authoritarian regime in Egypt? A question in particular about how effective international human rights organizations and lawyers can be in terms of contributing to freedom and to defending of human rights. And also a question about the role of the United Nations in terms of trying to apply international norms and standards to the behavior of the government. Can you just comment a little bit about what you see happening in terms of what works and what doesn't work in terms of external pressures?
That's a great question, actually. It gives me an opportunity to talk about one of the things that are really on the top of our agenda, on how to immediately, I mean, like there is an immediate crucial issue right now is to stop the prosecution of civil society organizations in Egypt and prevent them from being detained and sentenced to life. And the long-term issue is actually opening the public space for open and transparent debate and change and reform. For the immediate situation or general, the role of international human rights organization is very crucial at this time. And even though, I mean, governments or foreign governments are still supportive of the regime is still very keen on its image. And that's a window of opportunity for us because, I mean, the statements condemning, I mean, the what's happening in the country in raising particular cases or taking, just for example, I mean, what happened to the Italian students from Cambridge University, Giulio Rigni, who disappeared on the 25th of Jan of 2016, and then they found him weeks later, thrown on the side on a side road, and apparently was tortured to death. This is an important case because when the media shed light on it, this is a foreign student, it's an unprecedented case. It was also, brutal. The Guardian calls like. It was, he was tortured in an animalistic way. This is very important, not because there is more value for foreigners than Egyptians or local people, but it actually things like that help shed light on the broader violations that happen in the country. So raising cases like these are very important. People start asking questions, about the systematic torture and systematic forced disappearances that are happening in the country. And, raising the profile of a case help at least, even if the government tries so hard to cover it up, it makes it so hard for them to continue it. So, at least speaking publicly about it, issuing statements and raising questions in every, possible opportunity is very important. The more important thing is to sustain this because the Egyptian government knows very well they play on political fatigue. They understand that international policymakers and leaders always would have a bigger fish to fry. There are more important issues that comes on the agenda of, the world events are happening. Even the Middle East on its own, like Syria and the rise of ISIS and all this. So maybe someone would issue a statement today or next month or the next, few months about the situation. But after a while, these issues like fall down in the list of priorities and eventually fall off the media radar. It happened in our case. At the beginning, it's like the world was talking about it. 43 of us were on trial, 17 Americans included. We were being caged and our pictures everywhere. And a few months later, it's just like people forgot about it. And I used to meet people in the street and they tell me, it's like, oh, we're great. The case is over. And it's like, what are you talking about? I'm still on trial. But actually, this is a strategy, and that's what we try to fight, to keep the case alive, to remind people that there are people who are actually in jail, who have been in jail for, years now without a charge. There's the famous case of Shaukan. He is a photojournalist. He completed the 1,000 days very recently, and he hasn't been charged yet. And again, this is an example of a systematic way of the lack of due diligence and the lack of, respect for rule of law in the country.
Question about the economic fallout of the current situation. As you mentioned, one of the things that was promised by Sisi and the campaign was, economic development, stability, security situation that would enable the Egyptian economy to return to a growth trajectory. What's been the economic situation in Egypt, and how has the unrest and the lack of security and the protests affected the tourism industry and other sources of economic support for the country?
So let's talk about figures first. I mean, one of the obvious ones is the devaluation of the Egyptian pounds. Beginning of this year, it was 7 pounds a dollar. I mean, now in the black markets, it's 11 pounds a dollar. So that's a huge, level of devaluation that has not been seen in such a short time in Egypt. The second issue is that last year in March of 2015, there was the Sharm el-Sheikh summit. It was like an economic summit where, the government was just like providing, this huge messaging that there is enormous pledges for investment in the country and announced mega projects, including the new Suez Canal and the new Cairo, because there is already a new Cairo and they're having a new capital, and so on and so forth. But these things start in the media and die in the media, and we don't really see them materializing. And worse than that, there are no means of accountability or understanding where the money that was invested in these projects has gone, where the promises were, and if there are any returns on investment, if there were any investment in this, like this whole opacity around even how the decision-making process is done on what basis. Then and that's in terms of like the approach to governance. And the second problem is that, the playing the game of that we are in a war on terror is a double-edged sword. You cannot keep on telling the world we are like under threat and we are facing terrorism everywhere, and then say is like, please come and invest in Egypt.
Invocation.
And actually, the lack of competence and evident inability to combat terrorism is another issue. The decline of tourism is also, shortcoming that really hurt the country really badly. So all these factors combined are not helping the economy, and then it will affect the people who are in the streets. And just, a footnote to that, just to add to that, this is very problematic for this particular regime because, again, as I said at the beginning, this is a regime that positioned itself, that is there to provide, protect the secularism or the identity or the Egyptian identity or so-called Egyptian identity, and also provides stability and economic development. And the second argument that the government always presents is that those civil society organizations and human rights defenders are irrelevant to the needs and demands of the Egyptian people. They are advocating for Western elitist ideals in human rights that do not relate to our tradition and culture. And the Egyptian people don't want that. They want just want bread on their table. It's actually not true. Given looking at all the protests that erupted in Egypt, at least just in the past 6 months, they were mostly because of police brutality. And people took to the street just for dignity, not for economic reasons.
Dr. Nancy O'Kale, give us a hopeful scenario, in your most optimistic moments, as you think about where you would like to see Egypt go or the other countries in the Middle East. What would that optimistic scenario look like?
All right. Talking about Egypt, the countries that I work on, like Syria and Iraq, the situation is already very dark and the bar is very low in terms of the expectations. We've reached a point, yesterday when people are calling for, trying to stop bombing of hospitals, to reach a point that we need to say this, that is like, do not bomb hospitals. Right. That's a very low point for humanity in general. So it's very hard to actually talk about an optimistic point of view. Yes, yesterday there was a truce that was reached, and hopefully, the negotiation for cessation of hostility in Geneva will continue. There are different factors that would allow for that, and there are clear, factors that would lead to at least preserve the current truce. One of them is releasing of the detainees, allowing the humanitarian support to the siege, cities, allowing people to get medication is like very basic and simple and straightforward demands. But this is again, not to resolve the problem or for people to have like a real humane life, but actually to just like reach the basic level of survival. As for Egypt, I think there is more reason to be optimistic. One, because despite all the human rights violations that I have mentioned, despite all the arrests of journalists, the intimidation of civil society members and human rights defenders, people have not given up. And despite actually an incident that just happened over the weekend where the police stormed the press syndicate and detained two journalists from inside the syndicate and formed a blockade around the syndicate, people still went there and peacefully protested. And that's, a really great, a sign of resilience and sign of continuing to challenge. The other good part is that people are still using the formal institutional means to show their, their protest or demonstrate current policies and regime, for example, through the syndicates in particular. I mentioned the doctor syndicate and the press syndicate. And it's like these are all positive signs in that people are joining those people who are non-ideological at all. So these are not, either whether like extreme leftists or Islamists or anything, these are people are just having legitimate demands that represent their constituencies. So that's another, positive sign that people are still trying to resist and still trying to find a way to engage peacefully with the government. So it is an opportunity that it is very important to capture because very small, uncalculated, more repressive ways from the side of the government can turn things all the way to the other side. And we've seen the preview in other countries and how that ended up.
Well, thank you, Nancy, for that hopeful observation, particularly the resilience of the Egyptian people, which I think is remarkable. And that is about all the time that we have tonight. On behalf of World Affairs, I want to ask all of you to join me in thanking our guest, Dr. Nancy O'Kale, for this excellent discussion. And many thanks to all of you for joining us and for sharing your excellent questions.
Thanks a lot for having me.
You've been listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of conversations at the World Affairs Council. Ours is a membership organization. We're dedicated to engaging the public in conversations that matter. Visit us at worldaffairs.org to join us for the next conversation. This program featured Nancy O'Kyle. She's the executive director of the Tahrir Institute for Middle East Policy. She was in conversation with David Arnold. He's president of the Asia Foundation. This broadcast is made possible each week by the generous support of Chevron. Additional funding for post-production is provided by Maria Starr. She's a member of the KQED Producer Circle. Our recording engineer is Jim Bennett. Our technical supervisor is Monte Carlos. World Affairs is produced in association with KQED Public Radio. I'm Jane Wales. Thank you for joining us.